This is a reading of a small cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Spiritual Foundation of Morality. This is the third and last lecture in the series given in Norrköping, Sweden on May 30th, 1912. In yesterday's lecture, we tried to demonstrate, based on the facts presented earlier, that a foundation of morality and goodness exists within the human soul, and that only in the course of evolution from incarnation to incarnation have human beings strayed from their original instinctive tendency toward the good, and thereby allowed evil, error, and immorality to enter into humanity. If this is true, however, we should be astonished that evil can exist at all, and we are impelled to ask the question, how in the course of evolution has evil become possible? A satisfactory answer to this question can be obtained only by studying the elementary moral instruction that was given already in ancient times. Wherever instruction was given in the true sense of the mysteries, the pupils whose highest ideal was to penetrate gradually to complete spiritual knowledge and truth were always obliged to work from a moral foundation. The character of the moral nature of the human being was illustrated for the pupils in a very special manner. We will describe briefly how this happened. The pupils of the mysteries were shown that human nature can bring about destruction and harm in two directions, and that human beings are in a position to develop free will only because of this possibility of erring in two directions. Furthermore, they were shown that life can take a favorable course only when these two lines of deviation are considered to be like the two sides of a balance. As one side goes up, the other side goes down, and true balance is achieved only when the cross beam is horizontal. In this way, the pupils were shown that the right conduct of a human being cannot at all be described by saying this is correct and that is incorrect. Right conduct is achieved only through the fact that human beings are placed at every moment in the position of being pulled either to the one side or to the other, and must then themselves establish the balance. Consider the virtue of fortitude or courage. On the one hand, human nature may swing toward recklessness, that is, toward unrestrained activity in the world with full exertion of all one's forces. That is on the one side. On the other side, there is cowardice. The human being can swing, as it were, to either side, and the pupils in the mysteries were shown that if one swings toward recklessness, one loses oneself and becomes crushed by the wheels of life. If one errs in this direction, one is torn apart. On the other hand, if one errs toward the side of cowardice, one becomes hardened in oneself, and thus torn away from other beings and things. One becomes a self-enclosed being, whose actions cannot be brought into harmony with the whole. This is demonstrated for the pupils with regard to all human actions. Either one deviates and becomes crushed and torn apart by the objective world, thus losing oneself, or one deviates in the other direction, not just with regard to fortitude, but with any action, in such a way that one hardens within oneself. On this account, at the head of the moral code in all the mysteries, stood the important dictum, thou must find the mean, so that through thy deeds thou dost not lose thyself to the world, nor let the world lose thee. These are the two possibilities. Either we become lost to the world seizes and overpowers us, as is the case with recklessness, or the world becomes lost to us, because we harden ourselves in our egoism, as is the case with cowardice. Accordingly, the pupils in the mysteries were told that there is no unique and fixed goodness for which one can strive. On the contrary, goodness arises solely because the human being, like a pendulum, can always swing to one side or the other, and must find the possibility of balance, the central mean, through individual inner force. You have here everything you need in order to comprehend free will and the significance of reason and wisdom in human conduct. If it were appropriate for human beings to adhere to eternal moral principles, we would only need to adopt these principles, and we could then rigidly march through life. But life is not like this. Instead, the freedom in life consists in there always being the possibility of erring in the one direction or in the other. And in this way there also arises the possibility of evil. For what is evil? Evil is what originates when we either lose ourselves to the world, or the world is lost to us. The good consists in avoiding both of these. Evil has become possible in the course of evolution because human beings have erred to one side or the other, and because they did not always find the balance that were required to create karmic compensation at a future time. What cannot be achieved in one lifetime, in terms of finding the mean, is achieved in the course of evolution from incarnation to incarnation. A person who errs to the one side is then obliged, perhaps, in the next life, to swing to the other side and thus create compensation. Footnote: on Steiner's conception of evil as a duality, and for examples of karmic compensation, see his lectures of May 1910, titled Manifestations of Karma, especially lectures 4 through 8. End of footnote. What I have just told you was a golden rule in the ancient mysteries. As is so often the case, we find an echo of this principle among the early philosophers. We find that where Aristotle speaks of virtue, he makes a statement which can be understood only if we know that what I have just told you was an ancient mystery principle, which Aristotle received and embodied in his philosophy. That is why Aristotle gives this curious definition of virtue. Virtue is human capacity or skill, guided by reason and insight, which, in relation to the human being, holds the mean between the too much and the too little. Here Aristotle gives a definition of virtue such as has not been achieved by any subsequent philosophy. Because Aristotle had the tradition from the mysteries, he could find the precise truth. This, then, is the famous mean, which one must keep to in order to be virtuous, in order for moral power to stream through the world. Footnote: Aristotle 384 to 322 BCE. On his philosophy of the mean, see the title Nicomachean Ethics, especially Part 2, Sections 6 through 9, and the Eudemian Ethics, especially Part 2, Parts 6 through 5. See also St. Thomas Aquinas, titled Commentary on the Nicomachean Ethics, Volume 1, Lectures 6 through 11, and J. O. Urmson, titled Aristotle's Ethics, Chapter 2, the end of footnote. We can now also answer the question of why morality exists, for what happens when morality is absent? What happens when the too much or the too little holds sway? When either the human being is lost to and crushed by the world, or the world is lost to the human being. In each case, something is always destroyed. Everything evil or immoral is a process of destruction. And the moment we realize that when we do evil, we cannot do otherwise than destroy and eliminate something from the world, in that moment we are overwhelmed by the impulse of goodness. The task of the Theosophical movement, which is now only beginning to enter the world, is to show how all evil brings about a destructive process that eliminates something necessary in the world. If we now adhere to the principle that we have just enunciated, then what we know about the nature of the human being from our Theosophical world conception leads us to a specific elaboration of the nature of goodness, as well as of evil. We know that the sentient soul was chiefly developed in the ancient Chaldean epoch, in the third post-Atlantean cultural epoch. People today have little notion of what this epoch of evolution was like, for in external history one can reach back little farther than Egyptian times. We know, too, that the mind soul, or heart soul, developed during the fourth epoch, the Greco-Latin epoch, and that now in our epoch we are developing the consciousness soul. The spirit self will be developed in the sixth epoch. Footnote: the stages in the spiritual evolution of humanity mentioned here by Steiner presuppose an understanding of the full spiritual anatomy of the human being. As detailed in Steiner's books titled Theosophy, Chapter 1, and An Outline of Esoteric Science, Chapter 2, the complete human being of spirit, soul, and body consists of 3x3 members. In our spirit part, we have a spirit human, a life spirit, and a spirit self that are possible of evolution. In our soul part, we have three, one called the consciousness soul, one the mind or heart soul, and the sentient soul. And in our body, we have the soul or sentient body, the etheric body or life body, and finally the physical body. In the course of cosmic evolution, through extremely complicated processes, divine spiritual beings created the threefold human body and the germ of the threefold human spirit, and then brought these together to create an inner realm, the threefold human soul. In particular, part of the soul body was transformed into the sentient soul, part of the etheric body into the mind soul, and part of the physical body into the consciousness soul. The last of these steps, which represented the transition from a dreamlike state of consciousness to the first beginnings of individualized self-consciousness, was achieved by the end of the Atlantean Age. During the subsequent epochs of the post-Atlantean Age, human self-consciousness increased as each of the members above the physical body were successively refined as instruments of self-consciousness. This is the temporal sequence Steiner alludes to in the text. In the ancient Indian epoch, we had the transformation of the etheric, the development of the etheric body. In the ancient Persian epoch, the development of the soul body. In the Chaldaic Egyptian epoch, the development of the sentient soul. In the Greco-Latin epoch, the development of the mind soul. In our fifth present epoch, we are developing the consciousness soul. In the sixth epoch, we will be developing the spirit self. And in the seventh epoch, we will develop the life spirit. In the present fifth epoch, humanity has acquired the possibility of full self-consciousness, freedom of thought. Further evolution now depends on the conscious activity of the individual ego. Through the practice of virtue, the individual can bring about the transformation of the threefold body from within. The soul body becomes transformed into the spirit self, the etheric body into the life spirit, and the physical body into the spirit human. In this way, the eternal spirit of the individual comes to manifestation. The higher ego or higher self comes to birth within the lower ego. See Steiner, title Cosmic Memory, especially Chapter 17, and his lectures of November 18, 1907, Menschheits Entwicklung und Christus Erkenntnis, Lecture 17, February 29, 1908, titled The Influence of Spiritual Beings Upon Man, Lecture 4, and May 26 and 30, 1908, The Gospel of St. John, Lectures 7 and 11. It should be noted that Steiner often treats the human being as a four-membered being, consisting of physical body, etheric body, astral body, and ego. This is because the spiritual part of the human being, at the present stage of evolution, has not yet become individualized in most people, and because the soul body and sentient soul form a functional unity, traditionally termed the astral body, while the mind soul and consciousness soul have their unifying center in the ego. The end of footnote. Let us now ask, in what way can the sentient soul stray from the good, either to the one side or to the other? The sentient soul is what enables the human being to experience the world of objects, to come into a relationship with the objects rather than passing them by unknowingly. We find the one way in which the sentient soul can stray when we ask ourselves, what is it that enables us to have a relationship with our surroundings? It is what we may call our interest in things. This word, in quotes, interest, expresses something that in a moral sense is extremely significant. It is much more important to bear in mind the moral significance of interest than to devote oneself to a multitude of moral axioms, which may be beautiful or perhaps also trivial and sanctimonious. Our moral impulses are in fact never guided better than when we take proper interest in objects or beings. Please think about this. Because we spoke in yesterday's lecture of the deeper meaning of love, I will not be misunderstood when I say that even the usual oft-repeated saying of, quote, love, love, and love again, close quote, cannot replace the moral impulse that lies behind the little word, interest. Let us suppose we have a child before us. What is the precondition for our devoting ourselves to this child? What is the precondition for our being able to help this child? The precondition is that we take an interest in it. The human soul is unhealthy if it withdraws from something in which it should take an interest. The more one gets beyond mere preaching to the real foundations of morality, the more one will recognize that in a moral sense, the impulse of interest is an especially golden impulse. When we extend our interests, when we find opportunity to enter with understanding into the objects and beings of the world, our inner forces are called forth. If we take an interest in a person, our compassion is called forth in an appropriate manner. If we, as theosophists, set ourselves the task of increasingly extending our interests, of increasingly widening our horizons, this will promote the universal brotherhood of humanity. Footnote: the first principle of the Theosophical Society is, quote, to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. The end of footnote. Progress is not made by the mere preaching of universal love, but by the extension of our interest further and further, so that we increasingly come to be interested in and to understand people with widely different temperaments and personalities, with widely different racial and national characteristics, with widely different religious and philosophical views. Right understanding, right interest, calls forth from the soul the right moral conduct. Here, too, we must hold the balance between two extremes. One extreme is apathy, which is the cause of tremendous moral catastrophes in the world. Apathetic persons are indifferent to the world. They live only in themselves and stubbornly insist on their own viewpoint. In a moral sense, this insistence on a viewpoint is never something good. What is important is that we be open to all that is around us. Apathy removes us from the world, whereas interest places us within it. Through our apathy, the world loses us, and we become immoral. Apathy and lack of interest in the world are to the highest degree immoral. Theosophy, however, is something that stimulates the mind and helps us to comprehend and absorb the spiritual. Just as warmth comes forth when we light a fire in a stove, so interest in human beings and all other beings arises when we assimilate theosophical truths. Wisdom is the fuel for interest. Although it may not immediately be obvious, we can say that when we study those more remote theosophical teachings about Saturn, Sun, and Moon, or about karma and so forth, that these arouse in us this interest in the world. It is truly so that interest is what arises as the transformed product of theosophical knowledge, whereas materialistic knowledge gives rise to what is unfortunately so very prevalent today, what in radical fashion we must designate as apathy, and which, if it alone were present, would necessarily cause tremendous harm. Just notice the way many people go through the world, how they may meet other people, but do not really get to know them because they are shut up in themselves. How often do we find that two people have been friends for a long time and then suddenly come to a breach? This is because their friendship was based on a materialistic foundation, and for a long time they had not noticed that they had mutually unsympathetic character traits. Very few people today have a clear sense for what speaks from one human being to another human being. But this is just what theosophy should bring about. It should broaden us so that we acquire a clear sense and an open soul for everything human around us, so that we do not pass through the world apathetically, but with proper interest. We also avoid the other extreme here, inasmuch as we distinguish between genuine interest and false interest, and thereby keep to the mean. Throwing ourselves immediately into the arms of everything we meet is not genuine interest, but wanton loss of self. If we do this, we lose ourselves to the world. Through apathy, the world loses us. Through blind passion, we surrender ourselves to the world. Through healthy interest, we keep firmly to the mean, to the state of balance. In the third post-Atlantean epoch of civilization, the Chaldaic Egyptian epoch, the majority of humanity on earth still had the power to hold the balance between apathy and passionate, beclouded surrender to the world. This is what in ancient times, and even still with Plato and Aristotle, was called wisdom. The people regarded this, however, as the gift of superhuman beings, where in those times the ancient impulses of wisdom were still active. Consequently, from the point of view of moral impulses, the third post-Atlantean epoch may be called the epoch of instinctive wisdom. We may thus also experience the truth of what was said last year in my Copenhagen lectures, which are now available in the booklet titled The Spiritual Guidance of the Individual and Humanity, and these are on the web, I might add, as an aside, and there is a footnote, that's good, no, there's no footnote. There it was described, though for quite different reasons, how in the third post-Atlantean epoch, humanity still stood closer to the divine spiritual powers, and what allowed this closer connection was the instinctive wisdom. Thus, in those times, the power to find the mean between apathy and passionate surrender was a divine endowment. The mean or balance was still maintained through external traditions and customs. The complete intermingling of peoples that began with the great migrations in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch had not yet begun. Humanity was still divided into tribes and clans. In these, the interests were naturally and wisely regulated. The interests were active enough for the right moral impulses to appear, while the existence of consanguinity within the tribes held the passions in check. Even in our time, you will admit that interest develops most easily where blood relationship or genealogy is involved. There, too, what one calls blind passion is also not present. Because during the Chaldaic Egyptian epoch, people lived in limited territories, the wisdom-filled mean was easily maintained. The meaning of human evolution, however, is that what was originally instinctive and divine should gradually disappear, that human beings should gradually become independent of the divine spiritual powers. Hence we see already in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, the Greco-Latin epoch, that not only the philosophers Plato and Aristotle, but also Greek public opinion, regarded wisdom as something to be acquired. It was no longer a divine legacy, but had to be striven for. The first virtue for Plato is wisdom, and according to him, anyone who does not strive for wisdom is immoral. We are now in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch. We are still far from the time when the wisdom instinctively implanted in humanity as a divine impulse will be fully raised into consciousness. Hence, in our time, it is especially possible for people to stray in both of the directions we have indicated. This is why it is especially necessary to counteract these great dangers by means of a spiritual worldview, so that what humanity once had as instinctive wisdom can now become conscious wisdom. This is the purpose of the Theosophical movement. The unconscious human soul once received wisdom from the gods as something instinctive. But now the truths about the cosmos and about human evolution have to be acquired consciously. The customs and social mores in ancient times conformed to the thoughts of the gods. And we regard Theosophy rightly if we regard it as the investigation of those divine thoughts. In the past they came instinctively. Today we have to study them and raise them to consciousness. In this sense, we have to regard Theosophy as something divine. We have to consider with reverence that the thoughts conveyed to us through Theosophy are really something divine, something that we are privileged to think, since they are a reflection of the divine world order. When we relate to Theosophy in this manner, we realize that this knowledge has been given to us so that we can carry out our mission. Tremendous truths are disclosed to us if we study what has been imparted concerning the Earth's evolution through the stages of Saturn, Sun, and Moon, concerning the development of the different races, concerning reincarnation, and so on. Footnote: C. Steiner's books Cosmic Memory and An Outline of Esoteric Science, and a footnote. But we only take the right attitude to this if we say to ourselves, the thoughts we are pursuing are the thoughts according to which the gods have guided evolution. We are thinking the evolution of the gods. If we truly comprehend this, then we cannot help but be overwhelmed by something that is deeply moral. We then say to ourselves, in the past people had instinctive wisdom from the gods. The gods gave them the wisdom according to which they had fashioned the world, and this enabled the people to act morally. Now, in Theosophy, we acquire the wisdom consciously. Therefore, we can also be confident that this wisdom will transform itself in us into moral impulses, so that what we are absorbing are not just Theosophical truths, but moral impulses as well. Now, what is the nature of these moral impulses that we are absorbing? We touch here on a point of evolution whose attainment the Theosophist can certainly foresee, and whose deep moral significance indeed should be foreseen. We touch on a point that is far removed from what is prevalent today, namely what Plato still called the ideal of wisdom. Since he used a word that was commonplace when wisdom still lived instinctively within people, it will be good if we replace it with a different word. Because we have become more individualized and have distanced ourselves from the divine, it will be good if we replace it with the word truthfulness. We must learn to feel the full significance of this word. With respect to morality, this will be one of the effects of the Theosophical world outlook. People will learn to experience truthfulness through Theosophy. The Theosophists of today will learn how very necessary it is to feel the moral dimension of truthfulness. Nowadays one still talks about truthfulness, but due to the materialism of our age, the general culture is far removed from experiencing the moral need for this. Today this cannot be otherwise. Truth is something that contemporary culture must necessarily be severely lacking in, because contemporary culture maintains a different trait. I ask you, do people still feel anything today when they read something in a newspaper or somewhere else, and then learn later that what they had read simply wasn't true? I ask you to ponder this seriously. One cannot say one meets this at every turn. One must say one meets it at every quarter turn. Untruthfulness has become a trait of our present cultural epoch, wherever modern life extends. It is impossible to say that truthfulness is characteristic of our epoch. Nowadays, if you confront people whom you know have written or said something untrue, you will find, as a rule, that they have no feeling at all for the wrongness of this. They will immediately respond, "Well, I said it in good faith." Theosophists should not regard this as moral. People must increasingly learn to come to the point where they know whether what they assert really happened. In other words, one may say or report something only after one has felt and acted on the obligation to test with all the means at one's disposal whether it is actually so. Only when one accepts this obligation can truthfulness be experienced as moral impulse. Then people will no longer say, after having placed something incorrect in the world, "That's the way I thought it was. I said it in good faith." They will learn that one is obliged not merely to say what one believes is correct, but to say only what one knows to be true and correct. In this respect, a radical change must gradually enter into our culture. The rapid pace of life, the craving for sensations, everything that is a consequence of a materialistic age, all these are opponents of truthfulness. In the area of morality, theosophy will be an educator of humanity to the duty of truthfulness. It is not my task today to discuss to what degree truthfulness has already been realized within the Theosophical Society, but I will say that what has been expressed today must in principle be a high theosophical ideal. The moral development within the Theosophical movement will have enough to do if the moral ideal of truthfulness is felt and thought through in all directions. This moral ideal of truthfulness will be what produces virtue soul in the right manner. Footnote: earlier in this lecture, Steiner describes apathy and blind passion as the extremes of interest, but also stated that interest was a precondition for any sort of moral action. On the extremes between which truthfulness is the virtuous mean, compare his characterization of truth as the mean between error and fanaticism, one-sided truth. From October 29, 1910, in lecture Der menschliche Charakter. End of footnote. The second part of the soul that we have to speak of in theosophy is what we usually call the mind-soul or heart-soul, Verstandes- oder Gemütsseele. We know that this came into its own, particularly during the fourth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, the Greco-Latin epoch. We have already described the virtue that is particularly decisive for this part of the soul. It is courage, fortitude, bravery. Its extremes are recklessness and cowardice. Bravery, courage, or fortitude is the mean between recklessness and cowardice. The German word Gemüt expresses already in its sound that it is related to the part of the soul that is full of courage, mutvoll, the part that is full of strength and force. This was also the second or middle virtue for Plato and Aristotle. In the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, this virtue was still present in people as a divine legacy, whereas wisdom, as something instinctive, was still present only through the third post-Atlantean epoch. As you will have gathered from the first lecture, instinctive fortitude and courage existed as a divine legacy among the people who met the northward expansion of Christianity during the fourth cultural epoch. Just as wisdom-filled insight into the secrets of the starry worlds was present among the Chaldeans as a divine endowment or inspiration, so were fortitude and courage present among the Greeks and Romans, and also among the peoples who later took up the spread of Christianity. Instinctive courage was lost later than instinctive wisdom. If now in the fifth post-Atlantean epoch we look around us, we see that we are in the same position in regard to fortitude and courage as the Greeks were to the Chaldeans and Egyptians in regard to wisdom. We look back at something that was a divine endowment in the epoch immediately preceding ours, and that in a certain way we must strive for again. But the two previous lectures have shown us that in connection with this effort, a certain transformation must take place. We saw the divine endowment, which had a more external character, as fortitude and courage, become transformed in Francis of Assisi. We saw this transformation as the result of an inner moral force, which we recognized yesterday as the force of the Christ impulse. Genuine love is brought about by the transformation of courage and fortitude. This genuine love, however, must be guided by the other virtue, by genuine interest in the being toward whom we direct our love. Entitled Timon of Athens, Shakespeare shows how even love and kind-heartedness can cause harm if manifested too passionately, if they appear merely as a part of human nature, without being guided by wisdom or truthfulness. Shakespeare portrays a personality who completely squanders his possessions. Generosity is a virtue, but in Shakespeare's play, we see that what is squandered produces nothing but parasites. Thus we must say, just as the ancient fortitude and courage were guided by the European Brahmins in the mystery centers, by the wise leaders who kept themselves hidden in the background, so also in human nature must the virtue of love be harmoniously guided by interest, the interest that brings us into relation with the outer world in the right way, must lead and guide us when we turn our love to the outer world. This may also be seen in the characteristic but radical example of Francis of Assisi. The compassion and pity that Francis of Assisi had was not the sort that easily becomes obtrusive or offensive. People who smother other people with their compassion are not always actuated by the best moral impulses, and many people will not accept anything given out of pity. To approach someone with understanding, however, is not offensive. Under certain circumstances, pity is something that must be rejected, but no healthy person can reject being approached with understanding. Thus, if a person's actions are in accord with this understanding, these actions cannot be faulted either. It is this understanding that can guide us with respect to the second virtue, the virtue of compassion and love. Through the Christ impulse, this has become the virtue of the mind soul or heart soul. This virtue can be characterized as human love that is accompanied by human understanding. Compassion is the virtue that will produce in future the most beautiful and glorious fruits in human communities. For in a certain way this compassion and love will arise quite naturally as a feeling in those who truly grasp the Christ impulse. And it is exactly through the theosophical comprehension of the Christ impulse that this will become a natural feeling. Christ has descended into earthly evolution through the mystery of Golgotha. His impulses, his activities are here, are everywhere. Why did he descend to this earth? He descended in order that through what he can give the world, evolution may go forward in the right way and fulfill itself. If we now destroy something as a result of immorality, as a result of passing by our fellow human beings without interest, then we take something away from the world into which the Christ impulse has entered. Hence we directly destroy a part of the Christ impulse, now that it is here. But if we give to the world what can be given through creative virtue, then we augment the world. We augment it simply through our giving. Not for nothing has it often been said that although Christ was first crucified on Golgotha, he continues to be crucified again and again through human deeds. Because Christ has entered into earthly evolution through the deed on Golgotha, everything immoral that we do, every instance of lovelessness and apathy, contributes to the suffering and pain inflicted on him. For this reason, it has repeatedly been said, Christ is continually crucified, as long as immorality, lovelessness, and apathy exist. Since the Christ impulse has permeated the world, it is this that bears the suffering. Just as it is true that through destructive evil we withdraw something from the Christ impulse, and, as it were, continue the crucifixion on Golgotha, so too is it true that where we perform deeds of love, we help to bring the Christ impulse to life. Quote, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. This is the most momentous testimony of love. And this testimony must become the most profound moral impulse, once it is theosophically understood. We do this when we approach our fellow human beings with understanding and offer them something in our deeds or our attitude that comes from an understanding of their being. Our attitude toward our fellow human beings is our attitude toward the Christ impulse itself. It is a powerful moral impulse, a real foundation for morality, to feel, quote, "The mystery of Golgotha was enacted for all human beings, and from there an impulse has spread into the whole world. If you encounter other people, try to understand them in all their differences, whether it be of race, color, nationality, religious belief, or worldview. When you meet them and do this or that to them, you do it to the Christ. In the present stage of earthly evolution, what you do to your fellow human beings, you do also to the Christ." Close quote. This statement, quote, "I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it to one of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me," close quote, will become a potent moral impulse for those who understand the fundamental meaning of the mystery of Golgotha. Thus we can say, as the gods of pre-Christian times gave humanity instinctive wisdom, instinctive courage and fortitude, so does love stream down from the symbol of the cross, love that is built upon the mutual interest between one human being and another. Through this, the Christ impulse will work in a mighty way in the world. When the day comes that the Brahman understands and loves not only the Brahman, the pariah, the Jew, the Christian, but when the Jew understands and has compassion for the Christian as a human being, and the pariah for the Brahman, the American for the Asian, then one will know how deeply Christian it is to say, "There must be brotherliness among human beings, without regard to outer confession. We should give little heed to what otherwise unites us. We should care less for father, mother, brother, sister, even our own life, than for what speaks from one human soul to another. Quote, they who in this sense do not give little heed to the differentiation, to what hinders the Christ impulse that equalizes the differences among human beings, they cannot be my disciples," close quote. That is the impulse of love that radiates from the mystery of Golgotha, which in this regard we experience as a renewal of what was once given to humanity as original virtue. Now we still have to consider what may be called the virtue of the consciousness soul, temperance or self-discipline. In the fourth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, these virtues were still instinctive. Plato and Aristotle spoke of them as the chief virtues of the consciousness soul, inasmuch as they considered them to be the mean of what exists in the consciousness soul. Footnote. In Book 4 of the Republic, Plato distinguishes three souls, the rational, logistikon, the spirited or irascible, timoiades, and the appetitive, epithymikon, and characterizes temperance as the virtue of the appetitive soul when ruled by the rational soul. Aristotle characterizes temperance similarly in Nicomachean Ethics. End of footnote. The consciousness soul arises when the human being becomes conscious of the outer world by means of the physical body. The physical body is the primary instrument of the consciousness soul. And it is through the physical body that the human being comes to full self-consciousness. The physical body must, therefore, be maintained. If the human physical body were not maintained, the mission of the earth could not be fulfilled. But here, too, there is a limit. If people used all their forces only to satisfy themselves, they would shut themselves off from the world. The world would lose them. On the other hand, people who deny themselves everything increasingly weaken themselves and are eventually crushed by the external world process. People who overtax the forces allotted to the human being are taken up by the world process and lose themselves in the world. The body that has evolved to serve the consciousness soul can be crushed by the world, or the human being can come to lose contact with the world. Temperance is the virtue that enables the human being to avoid both of these extremes. Temperance is neither asceticism nor self-indulgence, but the proper mean between the two. This is the virtue of the consciousness soul. With regard to this virtue, we have not yet progressed beyond the instinctive standpoint. A little reflection will convince you that, on the whole, people are very much given to sampling the two extremes. They tend to swing back and forth between them. If you disregard the few who are endeavoring already now to bring some consciousness into this area, you will find that most people live very much according to a pattern, which in Central Europe is often described by saying, there are people in Berlin who indulge in various delicacies and treats throughout the winter, and then in summer go to Carlsbad, where, by means of the other extreme, they correct the harm they have done to themselves over the winter. You see, the balance tips first to the one side and then to the other. That is a radical case, but even if it doesn't always happen to that degree, this alternation between indulgence and deprivation is present everywhere. That is clear enough. The people themselves cause the excess to one side, and then let their doctors prescribe a so-called withdrawal program, that is to say the other extreme, in order to repair the damage. You see from this that in this area people are still in a very instinctive condition, and that we must say it is a kind of divine legacy, that people still have an instinctive feeling not to do too much in the one direction nor in the other. But just as the other instinctive qualities have been lost, so too will this one be lost in the transition from the fifth post-Atlantean epoch to the sixth. This will be lost as a natural legacy. And now you can judge how much theosophy will have to contribute toward developing more and more consciousness in this area. Very few theosophists today, even those who are more advanced, realize that theosophy is the remedy to bring about the right consciousness in this area too. When theosophy develops further in this area, something will come about that I can only describe in the following way. People will gradually have more and more longing for the great spiritual truths. Though theosophy may be mocked today, it will not always be so. It will spread, it will conquer all the outer opposition and everything else that still hinders it, and theosophists will not be content just to preach about universal love. People will understand that one cannot assimilate theosophy in a day any more than one can eat enough in a day for one's whole life, and that it is therefore necessary to assimilate ever more from theosophy. Within the theosophical movement, people will say less and less, within the theosophical movement, people will less and less often say, these are our fundamental principles, and if we have these principles, then we are true theosophists. Instead, what will increasingly spread is the feeling of always standing within a community, of communally experiencing the vitality of theosophy. Now, when people work over in themselves the characteristic thoughts, the characteristic feelings and impulses that come from theosophical wisdom, what takes place? As you know, theosophists can never have a materialistic worldview. They have just the opposite. A materialist would say, if a person has these or those thoughts, then the molecules or atoms of the brain are in motion, and because this motion is going on, the person has the thoughts. The thoughts emerge from the brain like a thin smoke or like the flame from a candle. That is the materialistic view. The theosophical view is exactly the opposite. There, it is the thoughts, the experiences in the soul, that bring the brain or nervous system into motion. The manner in which our brain moves depends on the thoughts we think. That is just the opposite of what the materialists believe. If you wish to know how people's brains are constituted, you must investigate what thoughts they had. For, just as written characters are nothing else than the result of the thoughts, so too are the motions of the brain nothing else than the result of the thoughts. Mustn't we then also come to say that people's brains will be affected differently when they are thinking theosophical thoughts than when they are in a club playing cards? Different processes occur in their soul when they follow theosophical thoughts than when they are in a card club or watching a movie. Nothing in the human organism is isolated. Everything is interrelated. One thing acts on another. Our thoughts act on the brain and nervous system, and this is connected to our entire organism, though most people are not yet aware of it. Once the inherited tendencies that are still in our bodies are overcome, the following will take place. Thoughts will pass from the brain to the stomach, and the result will be that certain things that still taste good to people today will no longer taste good to those who have absorbed theosophical thoughts. The thoughts that theosophists take in are divine thoughts. These act upon the whole organism in such a manner that what is good for it will also taste good. What is not good for the organism will be smelled and found unsympathetic. This is an unusual perspective, a perspective that some will indeed call materialistic, but it is just the opposite. This kind of appetite, whereby one loves and prefers to eat certain things and hates and will not eat others, this will emerge as a consequence of theosophical work. You can also test this on yourself. If you notice that you perhaps have an aversion to certain things which you did not have before you encountered theosophy, such things will become more and more common if people work selflessly on their higher development, so that the world can receive from them what is right. Only one must not play hide-and-seek with the words selflessness and egoism. In fact, it is very easy to misuse these words. It is not pure selflessness when someone says, quote, I only want to work in and for the world. What does my own spiritual development matter? I only want to work, not strive, egoistically, close quote. It is not egoism when people develop themselves, because in fact they thereby make themselves more suited to actively partake in the further development of the world. Neglecting one's own further development renders one unfit for the world. One withdraws one's power from the world. Here, too, we must do the right thing, so that what the Godhead intended for us may also come to manifestation. Through theosophy, a human race will develop, or rather a nucleus of humanity will develop, that does not take temperance as a guiding ideal merely out of instinct. It will have a conscious sympathy for what makes the human being a worthy building stone for the divine world order, and a conscious aversion to what destroys the human being as a building stone of the world order. So we see that moral impulses are present also where human beings develop themselves, and in this way we find instinctive temperance transformed into what we might call life wisdom, Lebensweisheit. The ideal of life wisdom, which will be a demand of the sixth post-Atlantean epoch, will also be the virtue that Plato called justice, the harmonious accord of the virtues. Since the virtues have somewhat shifted in humanity, what was regarded as justice in pre-Christian times has changed as well. In those times, the harmonization was not brought about by this sort of individualized virtue. Such harmonization was a distant future ideal. Footnote, compare Steiner's description of the early Greek conception of justice, quote, that which brings about the balance between suffering and happiness, between goodness and evil, is justice. But the Greek genius said to itself, when we look out over the world and we see that justice is present to a very limited degree in the world, within the human ego and astral body. The Greeks experienced the feebleness of the human being with respect to justice. Out in nature, however, they saw the ceaseless flux, the rising and the setting of the sun, the flourishing and fading of the plant world, and experienced in this a far deeper justice than can be realized by the feeble human being. They looked upward and said to themselves, behind what we can see, there must exist hidden forces and powers which regulate everything. Although they are hidden, they must be there. The Greek genius recognized these and called them the Titans, because they were not like the feeble human beings, and Themis, the goddess of justice, is one of the female Titans. From a lecture of October 21, 1910, Dimission des Zornes. In other lectures, Steiner indicates that justice is specifically related to the regulation of the physical forces of the human being. January 15, 1915, in a lecture called The Great Virtues, and August 6, 1916, in The Riddle of Humanity, Lecture 5. In this sense, it is equivalent to the future virtue of life wisdom, except that with life wisdom, the individual will consciously regulate the physical body from within. End of footnote. We have seen that courage transformed itself into the moral impulse of love. We have also seen that wisdom became truthfulness, the virtue that can place the human being worthily and properly into everyday life. But if we want to come to truthfulness with regard to the spiritual world, how can we do this? We come to outer truthfulness, to what glows in our sentient soul as virtue, through right understanding, through right interest. What then is interest with regard to the spiritual world? If we want to meet the physical world, or to start with a human being, then we must open ourselves to the nature of this being. But how do we open ourselves with regard to the spiritual world? We can do this if we develop a very particular kind of feeling, a feeling that also developed in history when the old instinctive wisdom had sunk into the depths of the soul. It is a feeling that we often find the Greeks describing with the dictum, "All philosophy begins with wonder, with astonishment." When wonder and astonishment are placed at the beginning of our relationship to the supersensible world, this is also the expression of something essentially moral. The great phenomena of the world do not at first call forth much wonder from uncultivated persons. It is exactly through spiritual development that people come to discover the riddles in everyday phenomena, to get a hint of the spirituality behind them. It is wonder that leads our souls upward into the spiritual realms, so that we can come to know them. And we can only come to know them if our souls are attracted by the entities to be known. This attraction is what is brought about by wonder and astonishment, and also by faith. It is also wonder and astonishment that guide us to the supersensible. And at the same time, this is what one usually calls faith. Faith, wonder, astonishment are three forces of the soul that lead us beyond the ordinary world. If we encounter someone and are filled with wonder and awe, then we are seeking to understand them. Through understanding a person's being, we arrive at the virtue of brotherly love, and we can best actualize this virtue if we have approached people with awe. Then we shall see that awe is something that we must bring toward every person. If we do this, we will come to be ever more truthful. We will feel an obligation toward truth. We will sense ourselves drawing closer to the spiritual world, and through knowing this world, we shall reacquire the spiritual wisdom that has sunk into the unconscious realms of the soul. Only after the spiritual wisdom had disappeared did the saying arise that philosophy begins with wonder and astonishment. This can make clear to you that wonder and astonishment first entered evolution at the time the Christ impulse came into the world. Since we have already spoken about the second virtue, about love, let us now turn our attention to what is presently still instinctive temperance, but which we have said will in future become life wisdom. With temperance and with life wisdom, we are concerned with ourselves. We act, as it were, in such a way that through our actions in the world, we take care of ourselves. For this reason, it is necessary that we also acquire a more objective standard. In Greek times, in the fourth post-Atlantean epoch, something arose that I have often spoken about in other settings, namely conscience. Footnote, see for example Steiner's lectures of August 25, 1909, The East in the Light of the West, Lecture 3, October 25, 1909, and May 2nd and 8th, 1910, titled The Christ Impulse and the Development of Ego Consciousness, Lectures 6 and 7, and May 5, 1910, titled Metamorphoses of the Soul, Volume 2. It should be noted that Steiner's For Steiner, true conscience is not just internalized mundane authority, but is rather an inner experience of the higher self, an experience he also calls moral intuition. See The Philosophy of Freedom, chapters 9 and 12, from August 25, 1909, The East and the Light of the West, Lecture 3, August 20th, 1922, titled The Evolution of Consciousness, Lecture 2, and October 7th, 1922, The Younger Generation, Lecture 5, the end of the footnote. One can clearly trace how in the old Greek dramas, such as those of Aeschylus, the Erinyes or Furies play a role that with Euripides is transformed into conscience. From this we see that what we call conscience did not at all exist in earlier times. Conscience is something that stands there as a standard for our actions when we go too far in our demands or in seeking our own advantage. It acts as a standard that places itself between our sympathies and antipathies. We thereby acquire something that is more objective, as it were, something that acts more toward the outside compared to the virtues of truthfulness, love, and life wisdom. Love stands here in the middle and acts as something that must permeate and regulate all of life. It must regulate all of social life and must also work regulatively on the inner impulses we have developed. Footnote: here Steiner does not give different names to love that is active in outer life and love that is active inwardly. Compare, however, the distinction he makes elsewhere between love, the experience of the other in one's own soul, and devotion, or self-surrender, the experience of oneself in the other. From A Road to Self-Knowledge and The Threshold of the Spiritual World, Part 2, Chapter 9, end of footnote. What we have developed as truthfulness, on the other hand, will manifest as faith in spiritual knowledge. And life wisdom, that which applies to ourselves, we must still experience as a divine spiritual regulator, one that leads us securely along the path of the mean, just as conscience does. If we had time, it would be very easy to answer the various objections that could be raised at this point. Some people, for instance, would deny that conscience and wonder are qualities that have appeared only gradually within humanity, and instead maintain that they are eternal characteristics of human nature. Footnote: earlier in May 1912, Steiner also listed compassion, brotherly love, as a characteristic that first appeared during the fourth post-Atlantean cultural epoch, from May 14, 1912, titled Earthly and Cosmic Man, Lecture 6. On the other hand, devotion was already present among the ancient Indians of the first post-Atlantean cultural epoch. End of footnote. In fact, however, they are not, and those who maintain that they are demonstrate only that they do not know the relevant facts. People will increasingly come to recognize that in ancient times, human beings had not descended so far toward the physical plane, and thus still retained a connection with the divine impulses. They were in a condition that will be reacquired consciously when human beings become governed by truthfulness, love, and the art of life in regard to matters of the physical plane. And when in regard to spiritual knowledge, they become governed by faith in the supersensible world. This need not be a faith that leads directly into the supersensible world, but ultimately it will transform itself into spiritual knowledge. And as it is with faith, so too is it with love that works outwardly. And conscience is what will work regulatively into the consciousness soul. Footnote: Steiner alludes here to a subject that he spoke of frequently between 1910 and 1912. Quote, "That which has hitherto had a justified place in the world as faith will be replaced by what may be called the vision of Christ." October 8, 1911, from Jesus to Christ, Lecture 4, close quote. Quote again, "Consciousness will build further on the foundation of the forms that compassion and conscience have thus far taken, going on to develop the spiritual vision that was previously attainable only in abnormal states of consciousness." To say this is not to make a prophecy, but to state a fact determined by strictly scientific means. from titled Christ in the 20th Century, May 6, 1912, end of footnote, footnote continues, end of quote, quote again. Paralleling the appearance of the event at Damascus, a great many people will experience something like the following in the course of the 20th century. As soon as they have acted in some way, they will learn to contemplate their deed. They will become more thoughtful and will have an inner picture of the deed. At first they will not understand it, but those who have studied spiritual science will know that it is not a dream, but a picture showing the karmic fulfillment of the act. They will know that one day what is pictured will take place as the fulfillment, the karmic balancing of what was done. What will make it possible for men to see the karmic pictures? It will come as a result of the soul having stood for some time in the light of conscience. From the Christ Impulse Lecture 7, May 8, 1910. End of quote. For further details, see his lectures of May 31st, 1908, that's the Gospel of St. John, Lecture 12, May 28th, 1910, Manifestations of Karma, Lecture 11, on the 7th and 14th of October, 1911, From Jesus to Christ, Lectures 3 and 10, December 2nd, 1911, Faith, Love, Hope, Lecture 1, and February 3rd, 1912, Conscience and Astonishment. See also the collection of lectures entitled The Reappearance of Christ in the Etheric. End of footnote. Faith, love, conscience. These three forces will be the three stars of the moral forces that will enter into human souls, particularly through theosophy. A moral perspective on the future can open itself only to those who think of these three virtues as becoming ever more enhanced. Theosophists will regard moral life in the light of these virtues, and these virtues will be constructive forces for the future. Footnote. Although Steiner does not speak here of faith, love, and hope, he did so at the end of Lecture 2. The forces of hope may be sustained by outwardly acquired knowledge of the teaching of karma and reincarnation. See Steiner's lecture of December 2, 1911, Faith, Love, Hope, Lecture 1. But the ultimate source of this knowledge is true conscience and its future clairvoyant development. Compare also Steiner's description of hope as the mean between doubt or despair and impatience. November 3, 1910, The Wisdom of Man, of the Soul, and of the Spirit, Lecture 7. End of footnote. We shall conclude by briefly touching on something that could be more securely founded if lengthier explanations were possible. We are aware that the Christ impulse entered human evolution through the mystery of Golgotha. We know that with the baptism in the Jordan, a human organism, consisting of physical body, etheric body, and astral body, received the ego impulse from above as the Christ impulse. This Christ impulse entered as the ego of Christ and was then absorbed by the earth and flowed into earthly culture. We know, too, that Jesus of Nazareth retained the physical body, etheric body, and astral body. The Christ impulse had been like the ego within them. On Golgotha, Jesus of Nazareth separated himself from the Christ impulse, which then flowed into earthly evolution. The evolution of this impulse signifies the evolution of the earth itself. Footnote, compare Steiner, quote, after the baptism by John in the Jordan River, when the ego of Jesus of Nazareth left the three bodies, the human organism that stood there contained in full consciousness that higher self of humanity, which otherwise works with cosmic wisdom on a child without its knowledge, during its first 3 years. From the Spiritual Guidance of the Individual and Humanity, Chapter 1. Close quote. Next quote, same footnote. In respect of the earthly life of Christ, the baptism was something like conception in the case of a human being. And we understand the life of Christ from then onward until the mystery of Golgotha when we compare it with the life of the human embryo within the body of the mother. From the baptism by John until the mystery of Golgotha, therefore, the Christ being passes through a kind of embryonic existence. The mystery of Golgotha itself is to be understood as the earthly birth, that is to say, the death of Jesus is to be understood as the earthly birth of the Christ, October 3, 1913, in the lectures, the Fifth Gospel, Lecture 3. On the subsequent resurrection of Jesus and his continued union with the Christ, see Steiner's lectures of July 7, 1909, The Gospel of St. John and its relation to the other Gospels, Lecture 1, and January 1, 1913, The Bhagavad Gita and the Epistles of Paul, Lecture 5. End of footnote. Please treat with all seriousness the things that I mention repeatedly, so that they may be better understood. We have often heard that the world is Maya or illusion, but gradually we must advance to the truth, to the reality of this outer world. The evolution of the earth is basically a process in which, in the second half, the half we are in, everything that formed itself in the first half now dissolves itself, so that everything physical we see around us will fall away from human evolution, just as the human physical body falls away at death. What then still remains, one might ask? What remains are the forces, the real forces, that were incorporated into human beings through the process of earthly evolution. And the most real impulse in this process is what flowed into earthly evolution through the Christ impulse. Initially, however, this Christ impulse cannot find anything on earth with which to clothe itself. In the further course of earth evolution, therefore, it must receive such clothing. When the earth has reached its culmination, then, as Adam was the first human being, so will the fully developed Christ be the last human being, around whom humanity, in its manifoldness, will have grouped itself. Footnote. Regarding the unclothed Christ impulse, compare Steiner's interpretation of the passage in St. Mark's Gospel, where Jesus is taken captive in the Garden of Gethsemane. Quote, among those following was a young man, with nothing on but a linen cloth. They tried to seize him, but he slipped out of the linen cloth and ran away naked. Steiner, close quote, Steiner indicates that this youth represents the youthful cosmic Christ impulse, the seed of a new world order who slips away and then reappears after the resurrection as the youth at the sepulchre. Mark 16, 1-6. See Steiner, September 23, 1912, The Gospel of Mark, Lecture 9, and April 10, 1917, Building Stones for an Understanding of the Mystery of Golgotha, Lecture 3. End of footnote. The words, quote, I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me, contain a significant clue for us. What is it that has been done for the Christ? Deeds that are done out of the Christ impulse, or under the influence of conscience, or under the influence of faith that is in accord with knowledge, these separate themselves out from earthly life. And inasmuch as through moral deeds and attitudes one gives something to one's brothers, one also gives to the Christ. I will express it as a sort of formula. Everything in the way of forces that we create through deeds of faith and trust, through deeds done out of wonder and astonishment, is something that is given over to the Christ ego, and that envelops the Christ like a sheath comparable to our astral body. We build the astral body of the Christ ego impulse through all moral deeds done out of wonder, trust, awe, faith. In short, through everything that paves the way to supersensible knowledge. Through all these deeds, we also foster love. This is entirely in accord with the words, quote, I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me, close quote. Through our deeds of love, we build the etheric body of the Christ. And by means of what is created in the world, through the impulse of conscience, we build for the Christ impulse that which corresponds to the human physical body. When the earth eventually reaches its goal, when human beings understand the moral impulses through which all goodness occurs, then will the Christ impulse, which entered into human evolution like an ego, be liberated. It will be ensheathed by an astral body built up through faith and through all deeds of wonder and astonishment, by an etheric body built up through deeds of love, and by something like a physical body built up through deeds of conscience. Footnote, compare Steiner's indication that the forces of faith, love, and hope... Let me read that again. Compare Steiner's indication that the forces of faith, love, and hope bring about the transformation of the astral body, etheric body, and physical body, respectively, into the spirit self, life spirit, and spirit human. June 14, 1911, from the lecture Faith, Love, and Hope. Compare also Steiner's remark in a letter to his future wife, Marie von Sievers, quote, "The being of Christ should be thought of as an inverse, macrocosmic human being, but identical with the second aspect of the divinity, the Logos." January 13, 1906, from Correspondence and Documents, page 83. On the relation of the human being to the Christ being, see Steiner's lecture of January 9, 1912, Cosmic Ego and Human Ego. End of footnote. The future evolution of humanity will take place through the cooperation of human moral impulses with the Christ impulse. Looking toward the future, we see humanity as a great organic structure. As human beings are able to integrate their actions into this organism, and through their actions create its sheaths, humanity will have prepared, in the course of Earth evolution, the foundation for a mighty community which can be thoroughly permeated by the Christ impulse. In this way we see that morality does not need to be preached, but can indeed be founded if one shows what really happens, and what really has happened, and what makes these things true as sensitive people feel them to be. It is always particularly touching to see how Goethe, after having lost his friend Duke Karl August, wrote a lengthy letter in which he described all manner of things, and how he then, this was in 1828, just 3.5 years before his own death, put down a wonderfully curious sentence, quote, "The world of reason should be regarded as a great immortal individual, which continually produces what is necessary, and thereby elevates itself to become master even of the accidental." Close quote. How else could we make such a thought more concrete than by imagining this individual actively and creatively among us, and by thinking of ourselves as actively and creatively united with it? Through the mystery of Golgotha, the greatest individual entered into human evolution, and by consciously conducting their lives as has been described, human beings will array themselves around the Christ impulse, so that a kind of covering will be formed around this central being. There is indeed much more that we could say about virtue from the perspective of theosophy. We could, for instance, make an extensive and important study of truthfulness and its connection with karma. Through theosophy, the idea of karma will increasingly have to enter into human evolution. People will increasingly have to learn to regard and conduct their lives in such a way that their virtues correspond with their karma. People will have to learn, through the idea of karma, that they may not repudiate their earlier deeds with their later deeds. A certain consequentiality in life, a readiness to take on the consequences of what one has done, will have to emerge in human evolution. When one looks more closely, one sees how far removed from this people still are. Although it is well known that personal development depends on the deeds one does, once the consequence of a deed is no longer apparent, people still do what they would, in fact, only be allowed to do if they had not done the first deed. A great feeling of responsibility for one's actions, a greater awareness of karma, that is what a study of this sort might yield. Nevertheless, you will still be able to discover much for yourselves in the guidelines given in these three lectures. You will find, for example, how fruitful these ideas can be when you develop them further. As human beings pass through repeated incarnations during the remainder of Earth evolution, they face the task of producing the balance, the middle condition, with respect to the virtues we have described. They face the task of rectifying through their own free will everything that they have neglected in the one direction or in the other, so that gradually the goal may be reached of clothing the Christ impulse. Thus, we see before us not merely the abstract ideal of universal human brotherhood, which indeed may also receive a strong impulse if it is founded on theosophy, but we see that there is something real within our earth evolution, an impulse that came into the world through the mystery of Golgotha. And we see, too, that we must work on the sentient soul, the mind soul, and the consciousness soul in order for this ideal being to become real, and in order for us to become united with this being as with a great immortal individual. The thought that the only possibility for further evolution, for achieving the Earth's mission, exists in forming a whole with this great individual, this leads to the following moral axiom. What you do as though it concerned only yourself, this separates you from this great individual, and you thereby destroy something. But what you do to build up this great immortal individual, as we have described, this furthers the life and development of the entire world organism. We need only place these two thoughts before us to see that they do not just preach morality, but give it a foundation. The thought that you are destroying through your deeds that which you ought to build up is terrifying and horrible and suppresses all contrary desires. On the other hand, the thought that you are building up this immortal individual, that you are making yourself a member of this immortal individual, this fires one to good deeds, to intensive moral impulses. Here, morality is not just preached, but thoughts are indicated that can become the foundation for morality, that can themselves become moral impulses. The more that truthfulness is cultivated, the more rapidly will such morality enter theosophical views and attitudes toward life. I have taken it as my task to speak of this in these three lectures. Although some things could only be alluded to, your own souls will be able to extend the thoughts we have touched on in these three evenings. In this way we shall also be united over all the earth. When we meet together in common study, as we have done now in Theosophists, Theosophists of Northern and Central Europe, and then allow the thoughts aroused in us to resound further, this is the very best way to help Theosophy establish real spiritual life at the present time. Though we must now part ways, we know that we are most united with each other in our theosophical thoughts. And this knowledge is at the same time a moral impulse. To know that one is united by the same ideals with others who are often distant in space, but with whom one can meet from time to time on special occasions, this is a stronger moral impulse than always being together. At the end of these lectures, my soul too is filled with this conception of our common endeavor. And if this is understood in the right light, I am convinced that theosophical life that unfolds in this way will also become spiritually grounded. With these thoughts and these feelings, I wish to express my farewell and bring our studies to a close. And that is the end of Lecture 3 of this small cycle of lectures. I would like, as the reader, an aside. This was in 1912, and very shortly after this, Steiner was expelled from the Theosophical Society. And that really, these things are really, the word theosophy, I feel, was probably accurately said, of course, here, but one could replace it with the word anthroposophy instead. And that I myself did as I read that word, theosophy, throughout these lectures. Just a personal aside.